This program is copyright 1991 by National Vanguard Books, Post Office Box 330, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946. All rights reserved. The speech you're about to hear was given at a patriotic meeting in Asbury Park, New Jersey, on September 14, 1968, by Dr. Revelo Pendleton Oliver. Dr. Oliver, professor of the classics at the University of Illinois for 32 years, is a scholar of international distinction who has written articles in four languages for the most prestigious academic publications in the United States and Europe. He is a veteran of the patriotic movement since 1954 and is one of the very few college professors who have dared consistently and vigorously to oppose and denounce the progressive subversion of American institutions and defacement of Western civilization. The possessor of a keen and encyclopedic intellect and an inimitable wit, Dr. Oliver is not only one of America's foremost patriots, but he is also among the greatest living stylists in the English language. In Race and Survival, Dr. Oliver was speaking before an audience consisting mainly of patriotic, conservative Americans. Even though the speech was made in 1968, it might well have been made to an audience of right-wingers today. For today's patriotic conservatives suffer from many of the same problems, the same wishful thinking, the same muddle-headed idea that we can save our nation while at the same time being nice to everyone, the same preoccupation with a mysterious conspiracy, race of conspirators not mentioned, as an explanation for all the ills of the world, the same obtuseness and failure to recognize that the New York and Washington establishments are not things to be saved, conserved, reformed, or restored, but are now and have been for many decades controlled by our enemies and ought to be regarded as such. To be sure, the possibilities for patriotic action are far different now than in 1968, and some of the strategies and tactics that might have been appropriate then are hopelessly anachronistic now. But Dr. Oliver's essential message, that a call to race is the only possible path to the cleansing and restoration of our nation and civilization, is a timeless message and one of permanent value. I invite you to give his speech your undivided attention.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mark Twain used to tell his friends about an incident that occurred in the 1890s when he was traveling through the South, which was only then, after 30 years, beginning to recover from the tragic and terrible failure of the Second War for Independence that was fought on American soil. One day he was riding through the back country of Georgia on a lonely stretch of winding road that finally brought him to a small river. Uncertain where he was, he looked around and he saw a nigger asleep in the sun on the banks of a stream with a fishing pole at his feet. So he shouted to the speaker, who finally awoke and shambled up the road. "You live hereabouts?" asked Mark Twain. "Yes, sir. I've got a cabin over there." "Do you farm?" "No, sir. I works in the cotton mill down the road a piece." "Well, what do you do in the cotton mill?" "I helps tote the bales from the gin, sir." "Well, why aren't you at work today? Isn't this the busy season?" "Yes, sir. Yes, it is, sir. But the cotton mill don't work today." Mark Twain was curious. So he asked, "Shut down for the day? I suppose you'll be going back to work tomorrow?"
No, sir. The cotton mill won't work tomorrow neither, sir."
"Well, that's odd. Why not?"
"Oh, well, sir. You see, sir, that old General Sherman and the Yankees, they done burned the cotton mill down."
Well, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Capel has, with great care and effort, arranged for us this closed meeting at which we can speak openly and candidly. As I understand it, it is not my function to alarm you or to summarize our present plight, which has been explained again to you today by abler speakers than I. If you were not alarmed, you would not be here. And if you have not already realized that we are living in a country once ours, in which all the positions of power have been occupied and are held by our enemies, then nothing I could say would be of the slightest use. I do not wish or intend to stir your emotions, to exhort or to urge. It seems to me that the most useful thing that we can do in this hour is to consider together what strategy, if any, can yet serve the American cause and perhaps save our race and civilization from extinction. To do that, we must try to divest ourselves of all emotion. Any military commander will tell you that he has had to learn never to hate the enemy and to be able to suspend at will even his love for his own country and his own people. As we all know, strategy can have but one objective, to win the war. All strategic thinking has to be based on the nicest, the most accurate, the most implacably realistic calculation of our own resources and of the enemy's resources. Such calculations must be made with cold objectivity, and the man who makes them must make them as dispassionately as though he were not concerned in the outcome. Emotion leads fatally to disaster. You underestimate or overestimate the strength of an enemy whom you hate, and affection invariably makes you overlook the unpleasant and disagreeable shortcomings of your own side, and to hope for miracles that will never happen. So let us discuss American strategy as a purely intellectual problem, conceding nothing to our emotions and repressing our hopes and fears. This meeting and this audience, I am sure, differs fundamentally from some patriotic rallies and pep sessions that are held every week throughout the country and are attended by well-meaning and hopeful Americans who, although they do not know it, are working in cotton mills that were burned down 20 or 10 years ago. But even so, I remind you explicitly that as every military man knows, strategic plans must be revised, often from day to day, as battles are lost and our forces retreat, and that strategic objectives must be changed or abandoned when they are no longer attainable. A commander must know how to recognize and accept strategic defeats. As we all know, when the 13 colonies began their war for self-government, their first and well-chosen strategic objective was the capture of Canada. We took Montreal and almost stormed Quebec, but we failed and had to retreat. From the American standpoint, that was deplorable. But George Washington saw that with the resources on our side, our defeat in Canada had to be accepted as final, and that objective had to be permanently abandoned, and with it, the hope that the war could be quickly ended by negotiation and without resort to methods and actions that conscientious men wished to avoid. Had any more of our very limited resources been spent in another invasion of Canada, the war for independence would surely have been lost, and the 13 colonies would have remained British territory. The strategic plan that was sound in 1775 would have been folly and madness after July 1776. Many Americans did not see that at the time. But fortunately, Washington's wisdom prevailed. And one result was that the colonial leaders took the hazardous and indeed desperate step of openly issuing a declaration of independence, thereby unleashing forces they would have preferred not to invoke. And incidentally, although we would like to forget it, inflicting suffering and injury and injustice on many innocent men and women. It's easy to convince anyone today that Washington was right. But strange as it is, after all the many and crushing defeats that we have sustained during the past decades, it is very difficult to convince American patriots today that a strategy that was sound in 1958 is mere moonshine in 1968. At some patriotic pep sessions that I have attended in the past year, I almost expected the next speaker to rise and stress the importance of electing Goldwater to the presidency in 1960. Yes, I said 1960, for that was the year in which an organization of which I was then a part made its first attempt to create a presidential candidate out of unpromising and refractory material named Goldwater. And it later proved itself unable to learn from its failure. At such meetings, you actually do hear people talking in 1968 about how to prevent the riots in Harlem in 1964, because some people cannot give up the platitudes that sounded so nice in 1958, and because tender souls think that it wouldn't be ladylike to know that the race war is now not only open and declared, but has already gone to the point at which it must be fought to a bitter and bloody conclusion. In 1958, there was a chance, perhaps one chance in 100, that what is called an educational strategy would work and spare unpleasantness. The race war, though then looming ominously ahead, was not yet inevitable in 1958. There was a slim chance that prompt and vigorous action could avert it, and there was a possibility of then invoking the power of the probably great numerical majority of Negroes in this country who don't want that war, but who are now caught utterly helpless and utterly powerless, caught beneath the wheels of the power machine that is going on and can be stopped only with violence and bloodshed. The nation was not yet bankrupt in 1958. Stringent and austere financial sanity could then have preserved a structure that was already dangerously weak. But 10 years have passed since then. Conservative and patriotic movements have conspicuously failed to accomplish anything, and we have been everywhere defeated. The United States has now passed the point of no return, and we can only go on to a dark future of inevitable violence, bloodshed, suffering, and death. That grim future can no longer be averted. The only question is whether we win or lose the last decisive battle. Perhaps I should not have said so much, for this is a select and informed audience, highly select and very well informed. You have been reading The Herald of Freedom, published by Mr. Capel, and the task force and the alerts issued by the distinguished soldier who preceded me on this program, General Del Valle. I am going to take it for granted, therefore, that I need not elaborate on 5 crucial points, each of which could be the subject of a long discourse and would have to be explained in great detail to an audience less well informed. First, this is war. It is a war which will decide whether the American people can or cannot recover their country from the enemies who have taken it from us and now rule us through the lackeys they have placed in all the positions of power. The war is at present a psychological war, for thus far there has been little shooting, only a little haphazard skirmishing in some cities with some of the enemy's advance patrols that were really scouting parties. Then second, our enemies and therefore their lackeys are utterly ruthless. And to imagine that they are capable of compunction, mercy, or honor towards us is to have hallucinations much worse than seeing pink elephants on the wall. Everyone knows that on the 11th of May, 1940, the government in power in Great Britain, composed largely of renegade Englishmen, deliberately had thousands and thousands of English men, women, and children slaughtered for the sole purpose of making propaganda. And everyone knows that the rulers in Washington are shipping many thousands of our young men to the other side of the earth for the three obvious purposes, of which the chief is that of giving to simple-minded people the impression that they are fighting communism. When a government massacres the people who elected it, you have reached the absolute bottom of human behavior. It is 0 degrees Kelvin on the moral scale. Third, as every soldier knows, in the Western world, war is a highly moral activity, for it is made possible only by the moral virtues of fighting men, their integrity, their honor, their loyalty, and their courage. There is no greater moral deed than that of the man who lays down his own life that his people may survive. But morality is the bond that unites us on our side. It is the obligation that we owe to those who trust us. It therefore follows that, as every military man knows, the most moral weapon is the one that will achieve victory with the minimum of loss to our side. To send soldiers to their death because you are too squeamish and don't want to hurt the enemy too much is more than stupidity. It is murder. You might as well fight. Fourth, I assume that this is a meeting of Americans who want to win. And that means win by whatever tactics are necessary. If that is our purpose, let's think in those terms. If that is not our purpose, let's go home and get drunk. Now, I don't approve of getting drunk, you know. But really, it is much more manly than playing Ring Around the Rosie and London Bridge is Falling Down in conservative kindergartens. Fifth, and this is the most important of all, I assume that you have studied the history of the subversion of Western civilization, the civilization of our race, during the past 3,000 years or during the past 30 years. That you have thought about it and have perceived that all the facts and conjectures about world conspiracy are really less important than the reasons why the conspiracies have always succeeded. Yes, there are conspiracies, and they are evil ones. But they are like a group of burglars who conspire to rob a bank and succeed because the front door was left open and the vault was unlocked. Those burglars were not supermen, and neither are the conspirators of whom we hear so much. If you have thought about it at all, you will have seen, but painful though the fact may be, the real responsibility falls not on the conspirators who deceived, but on their victims, the great majority of the members of our race who were so easily deceived. One does not court popularity by saying, "The fault, dear Brutus, lies not in our stars, but in ourselves." But it is true, and unless we recognize that, we are hopelessly lost. If you have thought about it, you now know the really puny little conspirators could have accomplished nothing but for our weakness. They found and exploited certain tendencies that are innate in our race and are, to some extent, more or less peculiar to it. Those tendencies are chiefly our love of fair play, our instinctive kindness, our capacity for pity, a curious passion for altruism and self-sacrifice, and an imagination so vigorous that it easily gets out of control. Those qualities are hereditary in the healthy parts of our race, and we think of them as virtues, as indeed they are among ourselves. But remember that what we call virtues seem ludicrous and contemptible to other races. The crucial question is whether we are capable of learning anything by repeated and bitter experience, whether a child that has burned itself 100 times on the same red-hot stove will finally learn not to do it again. So with this much preface, let us ask ourselves by what strategy, if any, we can yet win this war. Now, there are only 3 possible ways by which Americans can recover their country. Just 3 ways. They are, first, by politics. That way is still open, although it may not be much longer. George Wallace may represent our last chance. I cannot predict whether George Wallace will escape assassination, whether he will be elected, whether enough American congressmen will also be elected to give him a legal basis for his operations, or whether, if elected, he will have the wisdom, courage, and strength to do what is necessary. Yeah. But at the very, very worst, taking, if you wish, at their face value all the severest criticisms of him that you may have heard, at the very, very worst, his election would give us time and another chance, such as we are quite unlikely to have if either Tricky Dicky or Howling Gilbert. Tricky Dicky or Holly Hubert's song and dance acts, you must remember, are all on the same vaudeville circuit. The second way by which this country could be recaptured is through a coup d'etat by the armed forces. Obviously, we are not here in a position to comment on the likelihood of such an event. The third way is the way in which this nation was established in the first place, namely by an armed insurrection to overthrow the government in power. When you think along these lines, you should particularly perpend the very significant changes in weapons that have taken place in this century, changes which make the task much different from what it was in 1775, but we cannot go into that in cognate questions now. I have named the only 3 ways by which you can win. If all 3 are impossible or unsuccessful, there is no hope for us. That does not necessarily mean that if we go under, our enemies will finally realize their millennial dream of inheriting all the earth and the fullness thereof. Indeed, I think it quite likely that if they destroy us, the doom inherent in their own nature will overtake them not long thereafter. But that, even if certain, would be small consolation to us when we are dead. There are just three ways, then, of winning: by elections, by a military coup d'etat, and by armed insurrection of the citizens. It is perfectly obvious that to win by any one of these three ways, there is one thing that you must have: the support of a very large number of Americans. The support of a large number of people in all parts of the country. You will need the greatest number, of course, to win by elections. The fewest in the event of a coup d'etat by the armed forces. But even there, you would need the active adherence, not only of many enlisted men, but of a nucleus of civilians, and at least the passive acquiescence of many more. The task of Americans, therefore, if they really mean what they say when they talk about patriotism, is obvious. It is to recruit and mobilize that needed large number and to direct it against the enemy. If that cannot be done, or if we are too ladylike to do it, then let's stop playing games with ourselves. If we really want to win, then there is just one question before us. What is the most practical way of mobilizing as quickly as possible the popular support that we indispensably need and have thus far so signally failed to obtain? That and that only is the question before us. The metaphysical truths that you may sense, the ingenious arguments that may come to your mind, the moral principles that you may wish to display, and the knowledge that you have acquired are all irrelevant unless they help you answer that one question. It does not matter at all what kind of better world you would like to live in if you were asked to design it, and it does not matter at all what you would do if you found Aladdin's lamp or Gyges' ring. The one and only question before us is how we can obtain quickly popular support and how we can turn to our advantage the latent forces of discontent and resentment that are appearing and growing stronger among our people. To answer that question, look about you objectively. Don't worry about what forces ought to be there, or what forces were there 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 years ago. What forces are there now that you can utilize to effect your purpose? To what can you appeal to mobilize your countrymen against the enemy? You can't appeal to the Christian faith. That's deplorable, of course, but it is true. Active faith, and even the minimal fundamentals of Christianity, according to the best information that I have been able to obtain from men who are, I am sure, most sincere and devout Christians, active faith in those minimal fundamentals is now confined to a minority that amounts to no more than 12 or 15% of the population. And there is no likelihood that that number will increase in the near future. In Roman Catholicism, real Christianity is now, for all practical purposes, represented by the minority that holds the position taken in that excellent periodical, St. Michael's News. And I'm sure that Father Marion will pardon me for disclosing the secret that the subscription list of St. Michael's News is smaller than that of the New York Times. In Protestantism, Christianity is still found in a number of small fundamentalist churches, independent or loosely organized, and that is about all. To these, we can add a considerable number of Mormons, but that is no great number. And only a minority of this minority of Christians are willing to fight for their faith. And even they are divided by very real doctrinal differences that the enemy will not fail to exploit. What is more, many of the most earnest believers or converts, including, as you may have noticed, quite recently a well-known American patriot, believe that they have been informed of the date and the circumstances of the second coming of Christ and intend to govern their conduct accordingly. So, the old cliche, atheistic communism, which had a partial validity 50 years ago, is worn out. It will no longer bring you reproaches. I'm sorry, but that is it. You can't really inspire anyone, except a few manufacturers who have unfavorable markets, with eulogies of free enterprise. That is an abstraction that stirs no pulses today. You cannot appeal effectively to love for the Constitution. I'm sorry, but you can't. Do you know many people who are prepared to die for that document today? The Constitution, like the states' rights for which it provides, has a certain value as a symbol and as a form. But that is all. The Constitution, though it was defective since it was so easily subverted and destroyed, was the noblest system of government ever devised by the mind of man. But to convince anyone of its merits, you would have to give them a fairly long and comprehensive course in human history. And at the present time, you would have to give that course to men and women who have been processed in the mind-poisoning vats that the taxpayers have maintained for generations under the name of public schools. So you would have to begin their minds of all the lies and hallucinations that were injected into them in their tender years. I could go on for some time listing the ideas and principles that are much and properly venerated in conservative and patriotic circles, but that are useless for our purposes, as indeed the utter failure of all past appeals to them has abundantly shown. But mention of the Constitution has brought us to a fundamental point. We are trying to create the mass movement that we need to win. Not necessarily a majority movement, but it must be a large movement. And we can't do it by education. Any pretense that we can is either an illusion or a fraud. You cannot induce many people to read treatises on history, ethnology, genetics, or economics, treatises which, if they are really cogent, are necessarily long, involved, and difficult reading that requires close concentration and a very considerable amount of propedeutic knowledge. You cannot force any man to read such works. If you read them, you couldn't force him to understand them. And if he understood them, you could not force him to be convinced. Yeah. All these subjects include many uncertainties, where one can reach conclusions only by a nice weighing of probabilities. And all are open to endless quibbling, sophistic argumentation, and mendacious distortion by propagandists. And all of them have, in fact, been thus distorted and deformed in their presentation as ingredients in that intellectual slop that is dumped on our children from their first day in the kindergarten to the day on which they receive their fake doctoral degree from a modern diploma mill. The task of mastering difficult subjects is hard enough in itself under the most favorable conditions, when it is necessary to unlearn the lies and half-truths that were stuffed into the mind during formative years. The task is quadruply hard. I am not denying or decrying the value of study. On the contrary, every one of us here needs to learn all that he possibly can about history, ethnology, genetics, and economics, and there are other subjects that are relevant. We need to learn if we are to know what we are doing. We have only human experience and scientific fact to guide us in forming our policies and dividing our strategy. We could only by study and meditation understand the nature and power of our enemies, and what is even more important, our own weaknesses and illusions that prevent us from seeing realities. By all means, let us study, and let us encourage all who can and will to do likewise. But remember, please, that so far as our purposes here are concerned, all our study will be vain, all our understanding will be bitterly futile, unless we obtain that indispensable wide support. And most men and women simply lack the time, or the energy, or the inclination, or even the ability for such study. And it is obviously among them that we must find our recruits, can't educate them with our little books or our big books. When you consider what we must get to succeed, you will see that the very notion of recruiting by education is fantastic and preposterous. We need an army. If you have any doubts on the subjects, just ask any military man here what kind of army he would have in terms of both numbers and quality of fighting men if the requirements for enlistment were a knowledge of, let us say, just one book. Let us say the three volumes of von Clausewitz's Fundamental von Kriege. You can't recruit, therefore, by that kind of appeal. You can recruit only by the kind of appeal that does not depend on study and learning. You must appeal to some instinct in men so deep and so vital that no intellectual demonstration is needed. An instinct so deep and vital that the enemy has not yet succeeded in perverting and killing it. You must tell men what they know through their own nature to be true. And search as you will, I think you will find there is just one force left to you, one force that still exists in considerable strength, uncontaminated, because it is below the surface the mind wash reached, just one force, and that is race. And therein lies your one and only chance for victory. If you are too squeamish to invoke that force, you have, I think, already surrendered. And may God have mercy on your little soul. That is the one force which we can still invoke. The one remaining force that transcends all religious, social, and economic differences and clashes of interest. The one remaining force that can unite and inspire. We are the white men of the West, the men of Europe, from Italy on the south to Sweden on the north. We are the sole creators of the great and noble civilization that can alone lift our hearts. We are also the sole creators of the great instruments of power that gave us absolute mastery of the whole world until we, with insane sentimentality and blind folly, abased and disarmed ourselves before alien races that regard us with hatred and contempt. We are the white men of the West, of the United States, Australia, South Africa, Europe. We have always been the world's most hated minority, and we have made ourselves now the world's most despised minority. But I hope and believe that we, despite the alien poisons so long and so cunningly injected into us, are not yet sick unto death. The instinct of race is innate and strong in all human beings. It is a biological force second only to hunger, and it is often stronger even than sex. It is, unfortunately, weaker in our race than in others, being often countered or overlain by our racial tendencies to generosity and kindness that seem so ludicrous to other races. But the instinct is there in all healthy men and women of our race, and it can give us, I think, the strength that we need. When you appeal to the racial instinct, you obtain the recruits most quickly from the people who have been least infected with the venomous muck that the lie masters of the public schools daub over the minds of children. In other words, the least educated Americans, who are also, by the way, the great majority. The quickest response will come from working men. Let me remark, incidentally, that I have never been able to understand the willful blindness of conservatives who imagine that they can win anything without the support of the working class. What that response can be, you can see for yourselves from the spontaneous support that, despite the frantic efforts of the aliens who own all the major television networks and almost all of the press, has been accorded almost unsolicited and certainly unwon by anything that you could call a political campaign. The force of that instinctive, unsolicited support that has been accorded to George Wallace. You will find the quickest response, and even the majority that you need, perhaps, among working men. But the same response lies buried deep in the heart of the timid middle class that now lives in fear of the $50,000 mortgage on their $20,000 house. And of the stealthy but ruthless reprisals that are carried out against outspoken Americans by the aliens who control our business world. You have found, in other words, an issue that transcends all differences of class and status, unless, of course, you purposely try to defeat yourselves by lending yourselves to divisive agitation. Race is an issue so simple and clear that any white man can understand it from the promptings of his own heart, even if he has never spent a day in school. But that man's instinctive perceptions are confirmed, endorsed, and strengthened by honest scholarship and scientific research. The recorded experience of mankind, which we call history, is a record that can be understood only in terms of races and their innate propensities, capacities, and defects. And even the great problem of the rise and fall of civilizations, explained not in terms of some Spenglerian fatalism of the intellect, but in terms of sheer racial decay. All studies of ethnology emphasize the vast and unalterable differences between races, and we are now coming to understand that the innate physical differences are less great than the psychological, and that the mental processes of one race may arise from impulses that are incomprehensible to another. The science of genetics has in this country made discoveries that have produced in our understanding of the world in which we live a revolution more sweeping in its effects than the Copernican revolution in astronomy. Discoveries which will soon place in human hands, and unhuman hands, power greater and potentially more destructive than atomic fission and nuclear bombs. The debasing superstitions that are used to defile the minds of children in the schools are as patently false as a claim that the earth is as flat as a pancake, and they can be sustained only by a crazy scaffolding of lies and forgeries. It will collapse of its own weight whenever an intellectually honest man tests any one of its timbers. In other words, you have here an issue that is as intellectually impregnable as any conclusion of the human mind could be. And if you wish to carry on your patriotic activities on the highest intellectual level, you can do so. And you can do it with a comforting assurance that for all practical purposes, your conclusions will not conflict with the promptings of an illiterate American's heart. If you take race as your issue, you will no longer have to run around forcing on your bored friends little books that prolixly explain all the world ills have been caused by a dreadful conspiracy organized in 1847 by a wicked man named Karl Mordecai, alias Marx. Pity his name wasn't Smith, isn't it? Or, if you want to go beyond that story, you won't have to go around handing out little books that even more prolixly explain that all the world's sorrows were contrived by a dreadful conspiracy organized in 1776 by a wicked man named Adam Weishaupt. Pity his name wasn't Smith, isn't it? Those little books, you know, though generally accurate so far, frequently fail to convince the average reader. Because whether he consciously formulates his objections or not,